forms of Joker Raiders?
Yes.
But you didn't say which vectors they acted on.
Which what?
Vectors they acted on.
They act on the coordinates.
Yeah, but because you, I would expect that adaptation would be identity matrix times a factor, but it wasn't.
So the, let me review that. I was talking about the finite transformations, right?
Yeah.
So what I said is that the global conformal transformations, the ones that are well behaved, invertible in the plane with the point at infinity on the Riemann sphere, can be packaged into these fractional linear transformations, where A, B, C, D is an element of SL to C. So the group of 2 by 2 matrices with complex entries and unit determinant. Okay, so. So what was the problem? So let's look at the various terms. So let's look at the translation. If I look at the finite transformation, it acts, so if Z goes to Z plus alpha, which is the translation, then the corresponding matrix M that does it is 1, alpha, 0, 1. Okay, if that's not a question, let me know. I'm interpreting this as your question. So then we had rotations. Okay, to be more precise, I'm only looking at the holomorphic side. So here more precisely what I meant is the transformation associated to the finite transformation associated to the generator L minus 1, right? That's the one that is constant. The infinitesimal vector field was constant. Then we had L0, where the infinitesimal vector field was linear. A dilatation does that. So the corresponding matrix was root lambda 0, 0, 1 over root lambda. So it has a unit determinant. And then we had the quadratic transformation, which I guess, how did I write it? Let me see. I'm making it up, but so it was 0, 1. Let's call this alpha. No, 1 and alpha. So I guess what I was doing is this transformation. Sorry? So what did I write here? Oh, sorry, I forgot the Z, yeah, so sorry. So this is, so 1, 0, like that? Okay, so I guess now I'm, no, sorry. Okay, let's look what I did yesterday. And then you're saying it's 1, 0. Okay, minus beta and 1. Yes? Okay, thanks. Oh, no, did that answer your question? Yeah, okay. Okay, so this was the finite transformations, and today in the exercises, you will have fun showing how you can map interesting regions in the complex plane. into other interesting regions by applying these global conformal transformations. And this is a very useful trick, not only in conformal field theory, but also when you solve like a Poisson equation in two dimensions in some with some weird domain and boundary conditions. It is very useful to conformally map this to some nicer domain where you can solve things much, much more easily. Okay, so let's continue. So the thing to remember from yesterday is that we have these global generators, L1, L0, L minus 1. We have the corresponding anti-holomorphic ones. And of course, these guys should be related in some way to the conformal generators that we discussed earlier in the course that exist in any dimension, the global one. So they should be related to the fact that you have two translation generators in the basis that we used earlier in the course. We had rotations. In this case, we only have one, right? We're in two dimensions. You have the dilatations, and then you have two special conformal transformations. And these guys are identical, just a different basis for describing the fact that you have global conformal transformations. So some nice thing that you can try to do is to find the change of basis from kind of the canonical conformal generators that we've been discussing to the DeWitt generators, okay? And the way you should do it is it's almost fixed by the fact that at the end of the day, remember that when we're doing analysis in the complex plane, we were treating Z and Z bar in general as independent complex parameters. But at the end of the day, if we're gonna match them on onto the real domain, Z bar, so in the real domain, will analytically continue back to the stemma where Z bar equals Z star. So the only, these generators are obviously real. So the only way that, and the question is, what are the generators here? How do you make real linear combinations? So the only way you can do it is by taking things like that or like that. So I'm essentially telling you, identify which LNs correspond to the conformal ones. And you should see that the in particular, the infinitesimal vector fields associated to these are exactly the ones that we wrote earlier, okay? Bar, sorry, yes, here. Yes, they have to be real, so you have the real part of LN in some sense and the imaginary part of LN. Thank you. Yes, I was making the statement that in two-dimensional CFT, it is very useful to treat, to complexify everything. So originally we had x1 and x2, which are real coordinates, right? But now treat each of them as complex coordinates. If you do that, then z and z bar are two independent complex coordinates. But at the end of the day, I mean, if you really are in two-dimensional real space, you have to apply the reality condition. That's the reality condition. And all I'm saying here is that if you want to have real vector fields, which is what we have in the physical real space, you have to, the only possible physical real combinations are these two, which are the real and imaginary part of the lens. And furthermore, by doing this simple exercise, you will see that you exactly recover those vector fields, okay? So now there's gonna be a part that will be very similar to what we discussed in higher dimensions, so I think we can go pretty quickly over that, but I feel I have to do it just by moral obligations. So now we want to describe as usual, so we're gonna be interested in the conformal fields, operators, and we want to understand what are the quantum numbers that the conformal field will have, but that we know already. It will have to have a Lorentz quantum number or spin. And then we'll have to have a dilatation quantum number. Okay. The Lorentz quantum number is associated with the behavior of the field under rotation, right? So M is this rotation in the 1-2 plane. And I'm already telling you the part of the answer to that exercise. You can convince yourself that written in terms of these vector fields, M is just L0 minus L0 bar with an I. And the reason you can convince yourself is that if you write this down in terms of complex coordinates, not making in terms of complex coordinates, you get I z dz minus z bar. I wouldn't bet my life. Maybe I don't want. This sign, of course, is completely arbitrary. So for the time being, let me choose it to be like that. And notice that this guy does the right thing when it acts. It has the right interpretation as a rotation because it sends z to e to the I theta z, while it sends z bar in the opposite direction because they have opposite sign. Okay, so it generates a rotation on z in one direction and on z bar in the opposite direction. And the other operator that we want to diagonalize is dilatations, which will be the real part of this, which is z dz plus now z bar dz bar. Okay. And again, does the right thing. It maps z to z. But of course, if I rescale the both coordinates in the complex plane, it will also map z bar in the same way. And what are the quantum numbers associated to this? These are, we call them spin. So in two dimensions, spin is just a number. And now we want to relate this number with, so S is the eigenvalue under the rotation generator. And I want to write it in terms of the eigenvalue under L naught and L naught bar, but that's, it's just h minus h bar. Any given operator or state will have a definite, you can diagonalize it in a way that has a definite quantum number. Yes. Yeah, so that's what I said. If you want, I can put the minus sign in. Because it doesn't really change anything. And then I guess I have to put a minus sign here. Sorry? The only thing that matters there is the relative sign between L0 and L0 bar. Whether there was an overall minus sign is not important.
And I think for the dilatation, there should be one of those should be the bar generator.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah. So I wrote it right here, but yeah, it's L0 bar here. Yeah. Thanks. Okay, so that's for spin. Notice that H bar, don't confuse H bar with it's conjugate. These are just two different quantum numbers, one for L0, one for L0 bar. Okay. And now for the dilatation operator, the eigenvalue, which is the dimension of the operator, is the sum of H plus H bar. Okay? Very good. So there's something very special that happens in two dimensions that makes life much simpler. At least when it comes to the internal quantum numbers. So remember that in higher dimensions, we had, yes?
H minus H bar.
From this?
But this is like
I have two commuting operators.
The first operator rotates in direction, and the second operator rotates in the opposite direction.
No, but I have one operator is a direct sum, is a sum of two commuting operators. Remember that L0 and L0 bar commute. So I can simultaneously diagonalize L0 and L0 bar. And I'm just saying that if I act on a state, L0 and L0 bar have a definite eigenvalue. And M is just the difference of the eigenvalue of the first operator minus the eigenvalue under the second operator.
So H in this case isn't the same for S and delta.
Sorry?
H isn't the same thing in S and delta.
Sorry, I didn't
understand. H.
H? H is the, okay, so I should define. H is the, eigenvalue under L0. And H bar is the eigenvalue under L0 bar.
So there, shouldn't there be some I's and S? Maybe I'm
no, because, I mean, a rotation, yeah, so I wasn't terribly careful about this, but no, but the rotation tells you that if I have a spin S, I'll write it down more carefully with the right eyes. A rotation maps a field phi, transforms as e to the I theta S, right? And we will see that it's exactly what L0 does. But let's do it carefully now. Yeah. So the thing I was saying is that in higher dimensions, we had to worry about the fact that in higher dimensions, Lorentz, the Lorentz group is more complicated. And you have to specify, when we transform the field, you had to introduce those funny LAB matrices that were complicated and made life a bit more miserable. In two dimensions, that's not the case. So the important thing is that all irreducible representations of the Lorentz or rotation group are one-dimensional. So let's try to see if you agree with this. So imagine I give you a vector. Naively, I would say that a vector is a representation of the Lorentz group. It has two components. So how is this consistent with this statement? Okay. So the way to think about it, and maybe you're more familiar with Lorentzian signatures, so let's think for now for a second that we are in Minkowski space. And we look at a vector. Okay, so a vector has two components, say A0 and A1. If the statement I'm making is correct, it implies that there is a way of writing the vector in such a way that taking a linear combination of these two components such that it is invariant under, that doesn't mix with the other component, yes. For this second in Minkowski, because I thought maybe it will help, but whatever I'm going to say is identical for rotations. Okay, let me do it in parallel with Euclidean. Now, what's special? So imagine and I define light cone coordinates, x plus and x minus. So it's the x0 plus x1 and x0 minus x1, okay? So in these coordinates, the vector field, the vector has components a plus and a minus, okay? Now in Lorentzian signature in two dimensions, what's the name of the only generator of the Lorentz group? I mean, what does it do physically? I mean, it mixes time with space. So what is that? It's a boost. Yeah, so we have a Lorentz boost. And that's the only Lorentz generator in two dimensions, right? So the question is, what happens to A plus under a Lorentz boost? I heard some mumbling, but sorry?
Scales.
Sorry?
Scales.
It scales, precisely. Yeah. So the point is that under a Lorentz rotation under a boost. A plus does not mix with A minus. A plus just gets rescaled. Is this something that's clear? I mean, if you just write the usual Lorentz transformations of time and space and you write them in terms of Lightcone coordinates, that's what you get, essentially. And A minus also rescales, but in the opposite direction. Okay. So this is precisely the statement that the vector, which in higher dimensions is an irreducible representation of the Lorentz group, is reducible in two dimensions because the Lorentz generator does not mix under a Lorentz transformation A plus with A minus. That's a statement. That's what it means to be reducible, that if you start with some set, it doesn't kick you out of that set. Okay. And I could repeat exactly the same argument here. By put instead of using A plus and A minus, I could have said, if I use AZ and AZ bar, then in two dimensions, of course, there are no boosts, but you have rotations. If I rotate AZ, I get back AZ. And if I rotate AZ bar, I get back AZ bar. They don't mix at all. Okay. So that's incredibly nice because, I mean, is this point clear? Should be clear. Yes. Intuitively.
This is like, for example, A. If you decompose A along the light path, okay. So you can have only like in one direction it has to extend while it goes, and the other has to shrink because you're kind of making. If you look at, say, the diagrams.
Isn't it just gamma from Lorentz boosts?
They shrink. So one direction will be extended, the other will be shrunk.
That's more of a
very
But if you want to see it, just take the transformation. Okay, whatever it is. Hopefully we're making a mess, but something like this, right? This is how Lorentz transformation looks like. So if now introduce Lightcone coordinates, it really just, you get just the Lorentz factor. I mean, that's essentially what you're doing. So whatever you're expanding, so you only have two dimensions. You know, you have time dilation, Lorentz contraction, right? But now you only have two dimensions. So if one will have to dilate, the other one will have to contract. And that's exactly what happens. And at the level of formulas, just diagonalize this. I mean, just look at from here you can, of course, deduce how x plus and x minus transforms under a boost. And you will see that, if I'm not mistaken, you get essentially just gamma x plus. It's not gamma. It's some other, maybe it's the, try to do it yourself. I mean, it really is a consequence of this. Okay, so that what this essentially means, I don't want to spend too much time over this. Essentially, all that it means is that in two dimensions, all that I have to tell you, and from now on I'll be using again the intuition, I mean the formulation in Euclidean signature. In order to specify a tensor, an irreducible representation, all that you have to tell me is the number of z bar z components and z bar components that it has. You have n1 z bar components, n1 z components, n2 z bar components. And by an extension of this argument, if I perform now a rotation, this gal will just scale with a given weight, giving you back the same operator. Okay? And the weight will depend on how many z's and how many z bars they have. Essentially. Okay, so that will make our life easy because we won't have to worry about matrices. All that we will have to keep in our mind is that we're looking at phi with a specific number of z and z bar tensor indices. Okay. Yes. Well, it's exactly the same. Exactly the same. Just that you have to analytically continue x0 to. I mean, you wanna, I can do it in more detail if you want. You want to see it in more detail? No. Yes.
I have a question about notation. What does it mean for an index to be called z? Is that index going to take values?
No, yes. It tells you how it transforms under Lorentz transformation.
But it does not take values.
No. So in fact, I'll drop it. So now this was just to motivate, and then I'll just tell you they have a field phi, and I'll tell you that has weight h and weight h bar. And what you should have in mind is that h is essentially the number of z subindices, and h bar is the number of
n1 and
n2. Sorry?
N1.
Yes, n1 and n2. Yes. Exactly. Okay. So now we can start moving faster. So then. Now we can write the transformations properties of a primary operator in d equals 2. You will see that things look much simpler now. So first of all, remember that a conformal transformation in two dimensions is a holomorphic map. Transforms us like that. Remember that this was exactly the general formula that we had in the previous lectures, but now all these funny LAB matrices have disappeared because there are no matrices anymore. They're just numbers because the representations are one-dimensional. And now what I want to show is that, as I said somewhere here, that the delta, which is going to be the scaling dimension, is the sum of h plus h bar, and the spin is h minus h bar. Okay, so let's see that. And in conformal field theory, it will be very useful since we can think of the holomorphic side and the anti-holomorphic side separately. It will be very useful to always think in terms of the eigenvalues of operators and states with respect to L0 and L0 bar, and not necessarily directly of delta and S, even though they're trivially related. The object that we're really interested in is L0 and L0 bar. So now let's make a transformation like this. So first of all, what geometrically, what kind of transformation is this? And lambda is a complex number. It's a combination of both dilatation and rotation because lambda has a magnitude and a phase, right? The magnitude, well, tells you that you rescale with a certain size, and this rotates the vector by. This rotates the coordinate z by a phase theta. And now we can just plug this in here and see that phi tilde transforms like this as lambda minus h from the first term, lambda bar minus h, and then phi z z bar. Okay. Now I want to separate the two transformations into the dilatation and rotation. So from here I get that this gives you magnitude of lambda to the minus h. Sorry, I forgot. Here there is a bar, important bar. H plus h bar. So it tells you that it scales with some magnitude with charge h plus h bar. And then there is the phase bit, of course, the phase of that you get from lambda, lambda bar is opposite. So that's why you get a relative minus sign. Phi z z bar. OK? So from here, we read that indeed, these are the right quantum numbers. If I perform just a dilatation, you rescale by h plus h bar. And if I perform a pure rotation, the operator transforms as a phase with charge h minus h bar. OK? Very good. So now we have a clear physical intuition about what this originally abstract sounding object of L0 and L0 bar are. They just tell us the dimension and the spin of operators and states. Okay. Now, in two dimensions, you have to, if you want, you can make a further refinement of what you mean by a primary operator. And this is useful at times. Remember that they said in two dimensions, there are two types of transformations. We have the global conformal transformations. These are the ones, remember there was this SL2Z, SL2C, sorry, divided by Z2. And then we had the, sometimes they're called local conformal. The ones that were not globally defined, yes.
This expression, how phi tilde transforms, have we derived it from what we knew?
Yes, yes. Exactly the same formula. So this is the formula of how, forget about anything, just go back to, if you want general relativity. If you have a tensor with h lower indices, h indices with the z, and h bar indices with the z bar, that's how it would transform under recording the transformation.
But we don't have indices.
Well, what I'm saying is implicitly, the way you should think physically about this is that this guy has this many indices. So just think of, if you want, I can put the indices, but it doesn't help anyone. It just, the information about the indices is in one-to-one correspondence with information about h and h bar. So putting in the indices is kind of redundant.
But h and h bar do not need to be integers?
Need not be integers. That's weird. But that's a property of two dimensions. Yes. Any other question about that?
But like we can't say that those indices they take some values.
No. It's exactly the same as this, that this is an object that lives on its own. And I can ask how it transforms under it, and under the rotation, say. And I can characterize it by just writing something like that.
Like phi is a function of point, like of two complex coordinates. But those indices, they are not like arguments of a function.
It's just a label that tells you it's in that case, just that index just tells you what the spin and the scale quantum number is. There's no more information than that. It's not that it takes values. It's just this. It's exactly the same information as telling you what h and h bar is.
So like we can't think of like
from a
just of a number.
It's a number, yes. Oh. It's a label. Yeah, so the only clarification I wanted to make here is that we call a primary operator, a primary is an operator that transforms like that under all conformal transformations. Global and local, and then you can define the notion of a quasi-primary operator And these are operators that transform in that way under all global conformal transformations, OK? Only the global ones. If an operator is primary, it's of course also quasi-primary, because the global conformal transformations are a subset of the all conformal transformations. But a quasi-primary operator may or may not be primary. And an example of that that we will study is the stress tensor. So the stress tensor will transform nicely under the global transformations, under dilatations, rotations, and so on. But it will not transform as a tensor under a local conformal transformation. That distinction doesn't exist in higher dimensions, because in higher dimensions we only have the notion of the global conformal transformation. So we can just talk about primary operators. Okay. So local, remember, so we had this. We studied what are the vector fields on the Riemann sphere that were globally defined, and we found that only the vector fields d, zd, and z square dz were globally defined on the Riemann sphere. But then there are other local conformal transformations that are not globally defined everywhere, so they have a singularity either at the north or the south pole, that were of the type zn ddz, where n is bigger than 1 and n smaller than minus 1. That's what I meant. So these transformations that have a singularity, say, at the north pole or the south pole. Any more questions? OK, so now this I really want to go quickly by, because it's essentially almost line by line what we already did in higher dimensions. Now what the next thing that you want to do is to, given that we know how a primary operator transforms under conformal transformations, you want to know the constraints that conformal invariants will impose on correlation functions of those guys, of primaries. We solved that problem between the lecture and the tutorial in arbitrary dimensions. So let me just write down the answer. I have a moral obligation of doing it, even though at some level you've already seen it. But we can do it pretty fast. So what I want to see is the form of correlators of primary operators in two-dimensional conformal field theory. So the first non-trivial, and now we're on the full plane. The first example, the first non-trivial example is when you're on is the two-point function, and we already showed this would follow from the general prescription of demanding that the correlator is invariant under the global conformal transformations. You will get this. Where now, if you remember that we could read the dimensions from the behavior of the operator here, we can indeed confirm that the dimension was h plus h bar. I already said that. Now, for the three-point function, it's very similar to what we already wrote. You will have a definite scaling behavior. Some constant that we're interested in computing. And then these combinations of the scaling weight. And I have to write exactly the same thing. So Are you unhappy if I do this and I put a bar for every single letter here? I put a bar so I don't have to write again. Yes. Well, now that's a good point. Yeah, so let's see. Now, what happens? Okay, so that's something that I will have to explain later. If the theory has to be, if the collators have to be well defined, namely that if I have two operators and I move them around, and the value of the collator should not change, okay? So that means that H minus h bar will have to be an integer, okay? So even though h and h bar by itself, they can be crazy things, like, and we will see examples where h will be 1/16, things like that. H minus h bar will have to be an integer, and therefore will only depends on the distance. If I'm not mistaken. Good. And now for the 4-point function, I'm not gonna write it. It's exactly what I wrote before. So, yes.
So I mean, H minus h bar is spin, right?
Yes.
Why does it have to belong to
this? Well, okay, so the intuition about that is that the rotation group is compact. So the spin is quantized. So the thing that's not quantized is H and h bar separately. But rotation is a U1, is a compact group. So when you do a transformation, you have e to the I theta. So if you go around the group from theta to theta plus 2 pi, you have to come back to yourself. And that quantizes. Am I saying something? I'm saying something wrong to me. Yeah, so what am I saying wrong with that? No, saying that this argument I made would say that H. Ah, okay, no, that it can also have an integer because, I mean, you can have double valued representations. I mean, it's like in higher dimensions, spinors are representations of the Lorentz group, where in order to come back to yourself, you have to go twice around the group. So the spin still can be integer or half integer. So this argument that I gave was slightly wrong because that only works for tensor representation, not for spinors. For spinors, in order to go back, you always have to go twice. Yes?
But if H and H bar are not equal to each other, then the correlation function will not go. I'm sorry, if H and H bar are not equal to each other, then the correlation function will also depend on the angle. It will be true that if you rotate by 2 pi, you're going to come back to itself.
Uh-huh.
But it's still going to depend on the angle. If you write that z12 is r times e to this I some argument,
yes,
then you will still have the argument present.
You're saying that, okay, this will go like e to the I theta h minus h bar?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds wrong. Yes, someone says the resolution. I have to say that in most cases, that in any case, we will study h equals always h bar, but the derivation of the conformal ordered entities does not require that.
So,
yes.
How do you relate the fields to the these correlation functions to correlation functions of the fields in real space if we want actually a point x, y. Like, isn't that?
Yeah, if I had it in real space, I would have just written down the formula that I had before. And then the question is, how does that relate to here? So I would have said that this is. Yeah, so the question is precisely how is it true?
How are the fields related then? If you want to write the fields in real space. Because I can't see that that you've stated that, and I've been wondering about that.
So you want to know how the field written in terms of complex coordinates is related to the field written in terms of real coordinates? I mean, I it's the same. You just change how you label the points in space-time.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's why, I mean, this is a puzzle. I mean,
is it a possible solution that when you're, in the previous lectures, when we were dealing with the global conformal group in arbitrary dimension, we only considered real scalar fields, and under rotations, they have trivial dependence in the rotations. So they didn't pick up any vector. But if we allow complex scalar fields, then possibly if you rotate, then the correlation function can pick up some.
Well, in general, yeah, these phis are complex, but still.
When you write set 1, 2, are you sure that you don't mean the absolute value of?
Actually, I think that's what I mean. Does someone have my notes from last year? I wasn't very careful about this because I didn't want to go through, but I think it might be.
Chama, are we having a problem with that complex phase? Because these are an equal time two-point correlator, and it's okay to have that phase.
No, but the question is, no, this is not equal time. We're in Euclidean. Yes.
Well, shouldn't H minus H bar belong? I mean, it should belong to pure imaginary wonder, not to Z.
No, that H definitely has to be. No, H definitely has to be real.
Real?
Yes.
So what's H bar?
H bar is the eigenvalue under L zero bar. It's not a complex conjugate.
Okay. Last year you had just not.
Okay.
Sorry. Just that one my interest.
Sorry.
H bar equals H star.
Yeah, that's.
Not necessarily. I mean, you can have operators that have h equals 2 and h bar equals 0, like the stress tensor.
So, what did you mean? You shouldn't write people just h bar equals
h. No, but. Is that right? No. I mean, what did I write? That? I don't know. No, that's not true. As a punishment for myself, I have to think about what's wrong here, and tomorrow I'll sort it out.
Are these correlation functions rotationally invariant?
Well, that's the question.
But they should have the rotation symmetry, right?
They should be, yeah. They should be rotationally invariant.
So this should be dependent on the magnitude of Z.
Yes, but instead of writing this, and I want to make sure that's right. But I think that must be true, the magnitude.
I mean, it's only going to be true if the particles are bosons. And in a previous discussion, we only considered bosons because we had a real scalar field, and now we are more general.
Yes.
So it is not necessarily true that the correlation function does not depend on it, if the particles are.
No, but just, I mean, even if the particle has spin, the correlator should still be rotationally invariant. And the question is, in what sense is this rotationally invariant? And that's the thing I have to think about. So I'll sort it out this afternoon. So instead of writing another wrong formula for the four-point function, it's more. What I wrote yesterday is more. Yes.
Yes. So I did care about the H and H bars of both V.
Yeah. So that, well, that a priori we don't know here, but when we study that you want the Hilbert space to have positive inner product, we will find that one of the consequences is that, in fact, it's more than H is real. H will have to be positive. That's one of the unitarity constraints that we will find. So for the four-point function, now remember we had this funny cross ratios. So we had two cross ratios. But now the thing that you can convince yourself is that if you have, this will be constructed from the ratio of, you need the data of 4 points in the plane. So Z1, Z2, Z3, and Z4. Now in two dimensions, by definition, the 4 points are in the same plane. So that means that actually eta2 and eta1 are not independent. So in two dimensions, there is only one independent cross ratio. And you can show what the eta2 I wrote is written in terms of eta1 like this. Okay. So when we write correlation functions, modulo the thing that I have to check, there will be a function of just one cross ratio, eta1. And eta1 bar times the kinematical factor. It slightly generalizes this kind of expression. Okay. Good. Well, not good, but until tomorrow. Yes.
They are transforming under the Lorentz group, so the result is also transforming in the Lorentz group. So. It has Lorentz structure somehow, the correlator. That's what this.
Okay, yeah, no, I think that's exactly the point. Yeah, so.
The theta is the Lorentz structure of your correlator, the e to the I theta h minus.
No, what you're saying is that if I perform a rotation here, it's like yesterday. I mean, when we computed the vector, the object that appeared on the right hand side had some indices, right? So if I perform a rotation, the structure that appear here also transform. So I think that's exactly right. So if I perform, I think this is exactly the resolution. So do people understand the explanation? The point is that this guy is not a scalar in general, okay? So whatever appears on the right-hand side has to transform under rotations exactly as the left-hand side does, okay? So this guy is not a scalar, so it transforms as e to the I theta s, where s is spin, but this is exactly what we got here on the right-hand side. So the left-hand side and the right-hand side transform exactly the right way. I mean, they're covariant under rotations. They shouldn't be invariant under rotations, they should be covariant under rotations. Okay, okay, so I don't have to do it. Okay, sorry about that.
No, just another detail about this. There we mean that this is true if h is equal to h1 equal to h2, right?
Yes, well, yes, you can show that like we did in the class, that the correlator would vanish otherwise.
And for scalars, we will calculate the correlators. What if these were scalars, I'd say? We will do this calculation.
Well, for the scalars, H and H bar are the same. Right? The spin is H minus H bar. And then there is no funny business. So the wrong state, I mean, the confusion was that this should be invariant under rotations. That's wrong. It has to be covariant under rotations, and it is, because if these are fields with spin, this guy transforms under rotation exactly in the right way. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking, but it's exactly the right way that an object that carries a spin h minus h bar transforms. So therefore, this transforms, the left-hand side transforms exactly in the same way as the right-hand side does.
And in real space?
Sorry?
You said it's equal to 1 over...
No, so this was... This is when the question was, how is this related to the formula I was writing down? And this formula was true only for scalars. For vectors, we had this funny thing, right? We had this matrix J mu nu x minus y. And this guy, I mean, that's the point precisely. This guy is not invariant in the rotation. It transforms, but it transforms precisely in the same way that the left-hand side transforms. Is everyone happy? Thumbs up? Yes, 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 yes. Okay, good. Okay.
I'm still disagree because I think that the correlation function should be invariant, not covariant.
No, it's covariant. Well, no, I'm saying
because it's a physical, it's a some physical.
I mean,
did
you agree with this statement here? Were you unhappy yesterday or the day before yesterday with this?
But this function depends on the magnitude of x minus y.
Yes, but
so it's invariant.
No, but it transforms. It transforms. The MNU transforms under rotation.
This index will transform, but the argument is.
And the argument is not a magnitude. The argument also depends on the orientation. It's not only the magnitude.
What does it mean? Because the correlation is something I physically measure. So if I change the observer, why does it?
Well, if not the observer,
it's
I mean.
It's real.
The correlation is something I.
It's never really
at some point, right?
Yeah, but if you are currently measuring a boson, for example, it will change, the boson will also change when you change the system, so you have to change the correlation function. You have to transform also with the vector indices, and the phi has a lot of indices. It has h plus h bar indices. So you're transforming them implicitly, although you don't have the indices there, but they are not scalars, they have indices, h plus.
If you're not happy after the lecture, come and we'll fight it out. Okay. So sometimes being unclear is helpful educationally because hopefully it will be clear forever. Okay. So now.
Could I have another question?
Yes.
How does phi look like? The complex phi look like if it's a scalar.
How does what?
How does phi look like? A complex function if it's a scalar.
No, but phi, I mean.
Because d on phi has to be.
Phi is a function of x1 and x2. And I can just write, I can choose just coordinates instead of x1 and x2, I call it z and z bar.
It doesn't have to make some constraint on the derivatives.
No.
I
mean,
it's real.
It's just real, but. You can choose the right phi as a function of x1 or x2. I mean, I know there's a one-to-one map between x1 and x2 and z bar. So if I know, you know how to take derivative with respect to x1, you know how to take derivative with respect to z and z bar.
Excuse me, one more question. Is phi real?
In general, no. In general, it's complex.
Okay. So is it true that this field with spin like h minus h bar, but it has only one component?
Yes. And that was discussion there. There's only one component because a given component just rescales under Lorentz transformation. So it's a number. It's a number. It's not like a spinner in higher dimensions. It's a matrix, it's like a vector, right? Here is just a specific number.
So you're saying like we said that all the reducible representations of Lorentz are one dimensional. It holds not only like for these like vector representations. Like
this will be all the tensor ones. Even the spinner one is reducible. So the reducible representation of the reducible spinner into dimensions has one component.
Can you show it somehow?
Yes. I mean, it's
like we showed that we consider just like particle of spin one. Yeah?
How many ones? I mean, I can do it, but it's a bit of a.
Just an idea.
The idea is just look at. So you have a two component spinner. So you start with a Dirac spinner. Z plus and minus, right? Mm-hmm. And. Well, okay, at the simplest level is just how does the guy transform under a boost? You have to write the rotation matrix, the boost matrix acting on the spinner representation. I'm just saying that, that the boost is realized. So okay, delta psi will be essentially just a matrix. M alpha beta psi beta, where M alpha beta is just a chirality matrix in two dimensions, which is the Pauli matrix, sigma 3, which is 1 minus 1. So the rotation generated in two dimensions in the spin-off representation is the commutator up to I's and stuff, is the commutator of sigma gamma 1 with gamma 2, right? But this is the same as gamma 3. And a simple way of representing the Dirac matrix in two dimensions is to say that, is to use the Pauli matrices. The Pauli matrices have exactly the Clifford algebra relation, right? Maybe with a factor of 2. And therefore, sigma 3, which is the product essentially of sigma 1 and sigma 2, is sigma 3, which is diagonal. And therefore, under a rotation, which is just multiplication by gamma 3, the top component and the lower component of the spinner do not mix. Okay. Oh. So I will not bother about writing the infinitesimal transformation of that. You would know how to do it. You just have to expand. So take W to be Z plus epsilon as a function of Z and expand, and you'll get the formula that we, you know and love from before. And now let me just talk about the stress tensor quickly. So in two dimensions, naively you would say that the stress tensor, if I use complex coordinates, has components ZZ, Z bar, Z bar. I mean, the stress tensor has two indices like that, right? And Z bar Z. Remember that this guy is symmetric and traceless. Now, in complex notation, the metric written in complex notation, so you have Z, Z bar here, Z, Z bar. The metric is of diagonal, right? In the Z component. So you get something like 0, 1 half, 1 half 0. Okay. G inverse. So G with this would be with lower indices. With upper indices is the inverse metric. So you get something like 2, 2, 0, 0. So what is the, let's first analyze the, so the symmetry condition just tells us that there are three independent components, right? The TZZ bar is identical to this one because it's symmetric. Now tracelessness, it implies that T mu nu G mu nu equals zero, right? But this is using the metric here, is the statement that T ZZ bar equals zero, okay? So the component of the stress tensor with one holomorphic and one anti-holomorphic index vanishes, okay? So just identically zero. And then now let's analyze the conservation law of the stress tensor. Statement that energy and momentum are conserved quantities in a conformal. No, there are two, right? I have TZZ and TZ bar. Okay, well, if you put, so we're going to treat them, we're going to complexify everything.
But I mean, if you write down T, it's traceless. Yes. It's trace still the diagonal. So the trace is no longer the diagonal in the traffic.
No, of course, no.
Okay.
So now conservation of the stress tensor is just d mu. Depends how you want to write it. Okay, let's see. So I can evaluate this equation for nu equals z or nu equals z bar, right? And now I'm using the fact, okay, I will not show the details. I mean, it's really just plugging in the inverse metric here. Using the fact that tz z bar is zero, this implies that the z derivative of the zz component vanishes and that the z bar derivative of the z bar component vanishes, okay? So this is the statement, and usually we will now, from now on, since we don't care about these indices, after all this discussion about the tensor indices, we will denote t of z will be tzz, the function of z. So conservation law tells us something very important. It tells us, yes. Sorry, yes. Is that what you meant? Yes. OK, now as a punishment, I should do it. So I have z bar. OK, so all I did is to plug this in here, right? And then, OK, there's the other term. So there is this plus. So I'm evaluating this equation for nu equals z. And then I have nu z What am I doing? Okay, let me do it carefully. So I have dz, dz mu plus dz bar mu equals zero. Let me evaluate it for mu equals z. So I have dz, dzz plus dz bar z equals zero. Now I want to lower the indices. So from here I get dz, z bar. When I lower the indices, I have to change from z to z bar, right? And from here I just get dz bar, dz, z bar equals zero. But this guy is zero because it's traceless. So we get this equation, and doing exactly the same, you get this equation. So from here we conclude that T is holomorphic and T bar is anti-holomorphic, okay? And this will be very important. So the two independent components of the stress tensor are holomorphic and anti-holomorphic operators. Let me arrange this up. Okay. So something that we have not established yet, all that we know about the stress tensor so far is that it has, well, we know its Lorentz properties, and we know that it has we know its scaling dimension. It has dimension 2. Remember that I said the stress tensor in any dimension D has scaling dimension D. That followed from the conformal algebra. Remember that we said the momentum generator has scaling weight 1. And we write the stress tensor, and we write the momentum generator in terms of as an integral, special integral of the stress tensor. And that tells us that the dimension of the stress tensor has to be D. But now we're in two dimensions. We have this funny global, local conformal transformations. And we want to study what is the most general ansatz for the transformation properties of the stress tensor under conformal transformations. Okay? So when I want to extract from these stress tensors, and again, the good thing about CFT is that you can forget about the anti-homomorphic guy. It comes along for the ride. You can just duplicate essentially everything we want to extract from here the algebra of conformal generators. From which we will construct the Hilbert space. Of the CFT, which will have to be, whenever you have a symmetry, your Hilbert space has to be in representations of the symmetry. But before we study the Hilbert space structure of CFTs, we need to know what this symmetry algebra is. And just anticipating the name, this will be something that you probably have heard before, it's the Virasoro algebra, which is, if you want, from some point of view, is a deformation of the DeWitt algebra that we wrote down when we're just studying classical vector fields in the complex plane and demanding that, that this was the basis of infinitesimal conformal transformations. We computed the DeWitt algebra, and the Virasoro algebra is a particular one-parameter deformation of the classical vector field algebra, the DeWitt algebra. Okay, but in order to determine this, what is the conformal symmetry? We first have to understand how conformal transformations act on the stress tensor. Okay. So maybe I was trying to be a bit lazy. Let me. This is always punish you later in life. So let me not be lazy. So I wanted to skip the step of writing the infinitesimal conformal transformation for an arbitrary primary field. So let me write it, and then we'll write it for the stress tensor. So so expanding, we get so these are the two terms that you get by expanding the top equation infinitesimally. So if I take omega to be z plus epsilon as a function of z. Okay, I'm not writing the argument, but this is all a function of z. And it has two terms that by now we know exactly what it is. This was what I was calling the orbital part of the transformation that encodes the fact that the field has been shifted, the conformal transformation has shifted the point. And this is the spin part of the transformation that tells you the quantum number under L0, okay? Fine. So now what we want to study is the transformation properties under conformal transformations of the stress tensor. So there are several things that we know. I mean, we know that the stress tensor is definitely a quasi-primary operator. It transforms nicely under Lorentz, under dilatations, right? But we want to now explore, essentially what we want to explore is what is the most general transformation that the stress tensor could have, consistent with some basic physical requirements, which is that the transformation is linear in the parameter, right? I mean, we're doing linear transformations on the fields. So the transformation of the field should be proportional to epsilon or derivatives of epsilon. And it should be local. This is a local symmetry. So the expression on the right-hand side should only involve the field and derivatives of the field. So let's write this. The first part is just the statement that the stress tensor, okay, now maybe more careful, that the stress tensor transforms properly under, has a geometrical piece, which is just the orbital piece that shifts the argument of the field. The second part is what I said before, that the stress tensor has scaling weights. H equals 2. And H bar equals 0. So just using this general formula tells me that this is twice the derivative, so epsilon z prime t of z. Okay. So that's all that you would have if the field was a primary field. Okay. But now we have to allow for the possibility of, I mean, let's write all possible terms that you could have here consistent with what I said. A locality. There is a subtle point about Bose symmetry that we will discuss later, and that it has the right scaling dimension. So the scaling dimension of all terms on the right-hand side should be the same. Yes, you had a question. So this story was saying that the stress tensor in dimension D has dimension D. This came from relating the translation generator to the special integral of the stress tensor, and using the fact that the dimension of the translation generator is 1 as a consequence of the conformal algebra. Should I do it in more detail or? Yes, so. Do you agree with this formula? Oh, sorry, T mu 0. And then we knew that P mu increased has dilatation weight plus 1. That came from the commutator of D P mu equals minus I P mu. So if this guy has dimension scaling weight 1, the derivative has a scaling dimension 1 minus d, and then we have the dimension of d, which is d. And indeed, this guy has dimension 2. Okay. And now what the other thing that you can, so now the question is, what else could I write down here? And what you can write down, notice that here I have an object that in some sense has dimension 3, because it has, let's not count the dimension of epsilon. Epsilon in general doesn't have a well-defined dimension, but you have t with 1 derivative. So this has dimension 3. Then here we have t has dimension 2 with 1 derivative. So that's dimension 3 also. So I can write a different term, which would be local and linear on the field, which would be the third derivative of z. And then we normalize it in some funny way, c over 12. OK? This is a term that would vanish because it has 3 derivatives of the infinitesimal transformation for the local transformations. Sorry, for the global transformation. The global transformations are at most quadratic on the coordinate, so this guy would be 0. So dimensional analysis tells us that, in principle, in this case of 2 dimensions where we have this cookie local transformations, that we could allow this extra term just by dimensional analysis. Okay. There is one assumption in this derivation that we will derive later. You could have said, rightly so, that I could have added terms with more derivatives here. But that requires then that you need an operator multiplying that field that has negative dimension. So I could have said that I have a term with 4 derivatives here, like epsilon with 4 derivatives. But then for this to be consistent with dimensional analysis, I would need to put an operator on the right-hand side that has dimension minus 1. But we will see that in a unitary theory, the dimensions of all operators have to be positive. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so that's a good question. So that's this subtlety we're saying about Bose symmetry. We will very shortly see. So actually, in this language, I don't have a very good explanation for it. The simplest answer will come from relating, as we will show very soon, or maybe not in this lecture, but that there is, you can extract the properties of the transformations of any field under conformal transformations with the with something called the operator product expansion of the stress tensor with that field, okay? And then this term that you could naively had written down here that had two derivatives, well, first of all, if you had a term with two derivatives here, you would have to introduce an operator that has dimension one, okay? That may or may not be there, but the way to argue that is not there is the fact that this transformation, as I said, can be obtained. So this is not self-contained, but I'll come back to this tomorrow, can be obtained. From the behavior of the product of the stress tensor. So more generally, the delta, the transformation of the field phi is obtained. So this, I have some details that I have to write some integral, but for the time being, just ignore that. Follows from the behavior of the product of the stress tensor with the field in the limit where the argument of the stress tensor approaches the field. So you have, say, phi at the origin, and you have a stress tensor. And by knowing how these guys decompose, so the OPE is the statement that if you take two operators and you bring them close together, they decompose. So more generally, so let me do it more generally. So I have operator A times operator B. It can be decomposed into a sum of operators, which is a function of Z. OC zero, okay? And actually, scale invariance fixes completely the Z dependence of this. This will have to go like HC minus HA minus AB, okay? Okay, so just to say it quickly, and tomorrow we'll see it more carefully. The transformation is obtained from this operator product expansion of the stress tensor with the operator itself. So now this transformation will have to arise from the operator product expansion of the stress tensor with itself. But the result shouldn't change whether I put one or the other, the order in which I put the stress tensors, okay? So there is a certain boson symmetry under the exchange of the arguments of the fields. And what we will show is, or if you want, why don't you try to show that if you try to write a term here like that, it would not be invariant under this bosonic symmetry of exchanging the fields. But actually, this level, I'm sure there is an analogous argument, but I don't see it immediately how to argue away the quadratic term. Yes? Why is this? No, because under we can construct the global charges automatically from the stress tensor. And then we can read the transformations of it just from the conformal algebra. So we definitely know that it transforms nicely under the global part. What we don't know is how it transforms under the local part. But under the global part, it transforms as nicely as it did before. Remember that the generators of the algebra are obtained from the stress tensor. So we know how they transform under those. Okay, so notice that now we introduce this object, which is the central charge. And this object, we will see, is precisely will control the deformation parameter that goes from the DeWitt algebra of the vector fields to the Virasoro algebra. So this is, okay, so is the logic here more or less clear at least? Okay. So now, this was an infinitesimal transformation. With considerable pain, one can integrate this infinitesimal transformation into a finite transformation. The reason I'm going through this is that we want to extract from this the symmetry algebra that will act on the Hilbert space. And this will allow us to classify all our states with respect to the symmetry algebra. So that was infinitesimal form. The finite form is like obtained by doing consecutively many small steps. And so let me just know the answer. So if I do the finite form, so that z goes into w of z, then the stress tensor will have the usual tensorial part that you know. So this is how it would transform if it was a tensor, if it was a primary under the full conformal symmetry. But now it's clear that there is this extra piece. So that means it doesn't transform as a tensor. It has an extra piece, but it's a nice piece. So you can write it as C over 12 times some object bracket W with Z. This W of Z is called the Schwarzian derivative. And it's some ugly looking combination of derivatives. Well, it's ugly looking, but it has beautiful geometrical properties. It's essentially the third derivative of W with respect to Z divided by the first derivative of W with respect to Z minus 3/2 the second derivative of W with respect to Z squared divided by the derivative of W with respect to Z squared. So this inhomogeneous term in the transformation has this this form. One important property that this have is that what should happen to this term under global transformations? Sorry? Should vanish. So one of the defining properties of the Schwarzian derivative is that the Schwarzian vanishes if omega is one of these fractional SL2Z transformation, SL2Z, Z, Z. I don't know why I keep saying that. ZZ plus D. Okay. There are some nice properties that it has, but let's not worry about this right now. Okay. So now we have, I haven't told you how to prove that this is true from here to here. It will take a while, but it conceptually, it's straightforward how to go from the infinitesimal transformation to the finite transformation. And okay, now really in the next lecture, what we will do is how to obtain the Virasoro algebra, which is will be the symmetry of two-dimensional conformal field theories from this. And then after that, we will discuss the Hilbert space of the conformal field theory. And then we will start to see how unitarity imposes very strong constraints on the values of C and the values of H and H bar that the primaries can have. And then we will construct a family, an infinite family of two-dimensional conformal field theories that have a finite number of primaries. And we will be able to solve them completely, compute the complete spectrum of those theories. But that will be only next week. So I'll stop here.